The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
Roe v. Wade, in the grand scheme of things, is not that important.
I understand the importance that people attach to the Roe v. Wade decision.
Real history of the 1973 Roe v. Wade abortion decision.
The Senate has just confirmed.
Brett Kavanaugh is officially confirmed.
That will flip the decision.
We have been in our second civil war for over 50 years now.
A bunch of disorganized men are going to rid this country of abortion restrictions.
Doctors must protect life from the point of conception.
Are you sure you want to do this?
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back and good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, just like Father Simon just got done saying, I'm the bait and switch. I love Father Simon. That was so fun. I love listening to that, and he's so kind in his introduction. So I am the bait and switch. Drew is off today. He'll be back on Monday, but we are taking your calls at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The clip that you just heard was from the new movie, Roe v. Wade, that is going to be released soon, I believe. And this is the, it's a, not necessarily a Hollywood studio production, but this is a professional production. This is made by a professional production company, a pro-life view of Roe v. Wade. And so I'm very interested in seeing this, but we're also interested in talking about, of course, the issues around Roe v. Wade. Joining us today to talk about that is Dr. Michael New. He is a visiting assistant professor of political science and social research at the Catholic University of America, as well as an associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. Additionally, he's a fellow with the Witherspoon Institute, Princeton, New Jersey. Dr. New has both a doctorate in political science and a master's degree in statistics, which is going to come in very handy for this discussion, from Stanford University. Dr. New, welcome back to the show. Great to be talking with you again.
Ed, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
So we're talking about Roe v. Wade. We're talking about the debate over abortion, and as you heard in that clip, you know, the civil war that's been going on in this country for 50 years since Roe v. Wade. And part of that information war, I should say, is the is how the statistics tend to get a little manipulated. Now, I think it was Mark Twain, I think it might be all three at the Washington Post. I'm used to the I'm used to people judging correlation as causation, right? It's a common fallacy when you're looking at statistics, is just to assume that two things that are correlated are have a causal relationship. I'm actually not at all clear what the argument was in the Washington Post, but you do a very good job of deconstructing it at National Review.
Right. It was a really a very strange editorial, I mean, even by mainstream media standards, that people in the pro-life movement often have to deal with arguments that our efforts are ineffective, and I think that's wrong. I think we do quite a lot of good. This writer, a guy named David Bondrio, takes it a step further. Tuesday in the Washington Post, he makes the argument that the reason why abortion rates have fallen is actually because of the Roe v. Wade decision. It's not because of pro-life efforts. It's because we legalized abortion some over 40 years ago. So, as you can imagine, it's kind of an absurd argument, and I kind of do my best to deconstruct it in this National Review Online piece that I had yesterday. And as you can imagine, again, it's interesting what the title of the York piece is. He says that the anti-Roe v. Wade movement is increasingly disconnected from facts. But I think when you look at the actual facts, I think it's David Bondrio and the Washington Post, I think they're the ones who are disconnected from the facts. And I'll just kind of go through some of the fallacies here. First, he claims that, you know, abortion rates went up in the 1970s because women came out of the shadows. Well, the reason why abortion rates increased in the 1970s is because abortion became legal. You know, essentially, when you make abortion legal in all 50 states, for all 9 months of pregnancy, you know, abortion numbers are going to go up. And again, right, we have very good evidence and data of that. That's just fairly straightforward. Secondly, he claims that, you know, we've seen the abortion rate decline since 1980, and that is true. But he claims that the abortion rate fell because more and more people were using contraceptives. And it is true that contraceptive use has increased. But the fallacy of that argument is that if he's correct, you would expect the unintended pregnancy rate to be falling, or at least falling consistently. That has not happened. Since the early 80s, the unintended pregnancy rate has kind of fluctuated. So even though more and more women are using contraception, you don't see this consistent decline in the unintended pregnancy rate. So he's wrong there. The third thing he says is that the falling abortion rate is not caused by more unintended pregnancies being carried to term. And here he's just incorrect. That actually, we do have good data that a higher percentage of unintended pregnancies are being carried to term. The Guttmacher Institute, which is no friend of pro-lifers, they were Planned Parenthood's research arm up right until 2007, they actually collected data on this. And they found that in 1981, about 54% of unintended pregnancies were aborted. That number fell to 42% by 2011. That's the most recent year we have data. So when women face unintended pregnancies, they're now more and more likely to choose life. So every time I get a chance to talk to a pro-life audience, I always mention that statistic, because I think if more and more women are choosing life, it's because of one of three reasons. Pro-lifers are either changing hearts and minds, or offering more and better services to women through our pregnancy help centers, or we're passing protective pro-life laws. So all those things flow back directly to the activities of pro-lifers. So I really think it's the Washington Post and this David Von Driel. They're the ones who are disconnected from the facts. I think if you look at the evidence, it's just pretty clear that pro-life efforts are making a real difference. And if the efforts of pro-lifers about the abortion rate down by more than 50% since 1980, it's not contraception, and it's not because abortion was legal.
Yeah, Michael, and I mean, all these things there's a lot more support for that as causation as there is for the idea that making abortion more available means that there's less of it. That flies in the face. I mean, even if you've never heard of a correlation versus causation fallacy in your entire life, that flies in the face of everything that everybody knows about human nature. The more that you make things available, the more that they are put into use. And when you decriminalize something, when you make something legal that had previously been legal, those numbers don't go down. Those numbers go up. And if you want to see how that works, you can go into any state that has decriminalized or legalized recreational use of marijuana. The use rates go up. Now, they may not explode upward. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. They may stabilize over a period of time. But when you legalize something, you give it an impromptu, if you will, of legitimacy, and more people tend to indulge in it. And that's the way human nature usually works. And it's contradictory to everything that we know about human nature, that if something was illegal, people were making more use of it than when it was legalized. I'm not even sure how that passes the smell test, quite frankly.
Right. I mean, right. I mean, one important thing I always tell my students is that, you know, the law is a teacher, and that, you know, essentially when you legalize something, you give it legitimacy, you give it credibility. It's possible to advertise for things that are legal. You typically can't advertise for goods and services that are illegal. So essentially, right, when abortion became legal, or at least became legal in, you know, all 50 states throughout all 9 months of pregnancy, things changed. You know, public attitudes, public acceptance of abortion went up a little bit. Abortion facilities opened. They started to advertise. Women who wanted to obtain abortions didn't have to travel as far to get an abortion. So there's all kinds of things that, you know, led to more abortions happening. I mean, it's just basic economics. When the cost of something goes down, incidence goes up. And you saw that legalizing abortion made it easier to obtain abortions. It should come as no surprise that abortion rates went up, and actually went up pretty dramatically. And that's not only true in the United States, but it's true of other countries that have legalized abortion as well.
And we're speaking again with Dr. Michael New. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, if you'd like to join the conversation. I think it's interesting, too, that if you take a look at this, is that 1980 is sort of an inflection point where these the number of abortions really start declining. And, I mean, this is a few years after Roe v. Wade, 7 years after Roe v. Wade, where there's been this sort of free-for-all, if you will, up until that point in time, where this was a popular decision at the time, culturally popular decision at the time. But then you start seeing, in the 1980s, you start seeing this happening with less frequency. You also start to see the pro-life movement sort of switch gears. And as you say, you know, put more emphasis on the hearts and minds aspect. They're still challenging it in the legal forums, too. And as they should, one of the things that set off David Draley or Drail in the Washington Post was the law in Arkansas that was just signed by Governor Hutchinson there, which greatly restricts access to abortion. And as the columnist notes, it really flies in the face of previous Supreme Court precedent. But that's really the only option that we have now as in the pro-life movement is to challenge these things in courts, because the legislative approach has been taken away from us by that Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey decisions. So that's still an effective, I'm not sure how effective, but that's still a legitimate avenue of challenging this. But the other is to just convince people that abortion is wrong. And we have made pretty great strides in that in terms of public sentiment. And I would say that you can still say that's correlation and not necessarily causation, but I'd say that there's at least a stronger intuitive case that the Hearts and Minds campaign has actually been more responsible for the decline in abortions than legalizing abortion, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that pro-lifers need to pursue a multifaceted strategy. I always tell pro-life audiences it's not any one thing, it's everything. We need to, you know, change hearts and minds, educate our friends, help pregnant women in need, pass protective laws. And you're right, I mean, we have made gains in the core of public opinion. Gallup has been doing polling on abortion for a very long time, and they every year ask the simple question, are you pro-life or pro-choice? In 1995, only 33% of people identified as pro-life. Now that's always above 45. In some cases, it's broken a majority. So a lot more people are going to identify as pro-life today, you know, than was the case, you know, 20, even 30 years ago. So I think that, you know, that's an important development. I think 1980, that's a very important inflection point for another reason, that was when the Hyde Amendment was upheld by the Supreme Court in the Harris v. McRae decision. That we passing the Hyde Amendment starting in 1976, and that's an annual rider to the labor HHS appropriations bill that limits the ability of the federal government to fund elective abortion through the Medicaid program. You know, the pro-lifers in the 70s realized that we probably couldn't turn Roe v. Wade overnight. We could do some things to protect some unborn children and protect the conscience rights of taxpayers. So we started with the Hyde Amendment. And again, we really wanted to get the federal government out of the business of funding elective abortion through Medicaid. It was first passed in 1976, and went through a series of legal challenges, and it was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1980, and they effectively said that, yes, abortion is legal, but you're not required to pay for it with your federal taxpayer dollars. So it's interesting. That's not the only reason why abortion numbers have fallen, but it's an important reason. I mean, the Hyde Amendment saves tens of thousands of lives every year. I did a study for the Charlotte Loews Institute. My estimates indicate the Hyde Amendment has saved over 2.4 million lives since 1976. Sadly, the Hyde Amendment is now in jeopardy. Joe Biden, after years of support, indicated he now opposes the Hyde Amendment. You have Democrats, both the House and Senate, who oppose Hyde. So we have a real battle on our hands to save the Hyde Amendment and save tens of thousands of innocent human lives. But, you know, certainly back to your original point, it's been a variety of things. I mean, legislation has played a role, but so have pregnancy help centers, and so has changing hearts and minds.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Hyde Amendment. And again, we're speaking with Dr. Michael New and taking your phone calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. The Hyde Amendment just came up in terms of the COVID stimulus bill, and I was a little curious as to the timing of that. Not that I'm a fan of the Hyde Amendment. I'm a huge fan of the Hyde Amendment, very clearly. I was a little surprised, though, that it came up in the context of that relief bill, and I'm not quite sure why it did there, because, as you say, it's usually a rider to the annual federal budget, the HHS budget. Now, there's HHS dollars in the COVID relief bill, but I'm assuming that the previous budget restrictions still apply. Am I incorrect in that assumption?
Well, essentially, I mean, you know, this relief bill was passed without essentially high protections. So it's a relief bill that does include some relief for COVID, and I think most people, you know, think that's a reasonably good idea. But like any, you know, bill that spends money, there's lots of things attached to it. and essentially there's not Hyde protections on it. So, you know, money could conceivably go to, you know, abortion facilities or facilities that perform abortions. And pro-life legislators wanted Hyde protections put in place to see to it this money, you know, would not go to elective abortions. They did not see in getting those getting those protections placed on this particular appropriations bill. I mean, the Hyde Amendment hasn't died yet. The full appropriations bill that funds HHS, you know, has not been considered yet. That's really probably come up this spring. You know, pro-life groups are, you know, aware of this, and we're mobilizing. But yeah, this relief bill, though, you know, was a disappointment and a setback. It did make, you know, some relief money available, which, and there's not protections in place, you know, that would prevent that from funding abortions. But the Hyde Amendment is still kind of another appropriation that's coming down the pike that we're going to have to get ready for.
And Michael, I mean, the issue with that in the spring, I think that's going to be a very hard fought issue, because even though President Biden had spent decades supporting the Hyde Amendment, his party has not. And I am not necessarily convinced that he's going to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem when it comes down to that. And I'm not sure how much, even if he's inclined to resist an effort to strip out the Hyde Amendment, I don't know how much stamina he's going to put behind that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, even, you know, when he was a senator, we have, you know, letters here to constituents that say that I'm very proud of my record of, you know, not supporting taxpayer funding for abortion, and he cites the number of times he voted against it. But in 2019, as a presidential candidate, he just, you know, changed his tune. He just flipped and said, now I oppose the Hyde Amendment. So we really can't rely on him. I mean, this fight is winnable. I mean, even though Democrats do have majorities in the House and Senate, their margins are very slim. So it's just going to take flipping a few Democrats to preserve the Hyde Amendment. It's also possible that Republican senators could filibuster an appropriations bill that does not have the Hyde Amendment and block from passing that way. So it's certainly not over, but pro-lifers certainly have our work cut out for us.
We are speaking with Dr. Michael New and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's go to the phones. Laura in Mercer, Wisconsin would like to join us. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for what you're doing. I just wanted to let you know that I had a baby in 1979, and they showed me the ultrasound, and the ultrasound made it look like it was some kind of a monster. But now the ultrasounds show that they actually are babies, and I think that's made a big difference with technology, being able to see that ultrasound and actually when their heartbeat starts and all their different organs, and they look like babies now, the ultrasounds do. Where back then, they didn't look like babies. They looked like creatures. So that's my comment, and I'll get off so you can talk about it.
Laura, that's a great comment, and it reminds me of something else, too. I not long after Roe v. Wade, there was a very famous photo series of a baby in the womb. I mean, like across the full point of its gestation. I forget the name of the photographer, very famous series. It was beautiful, beautiful photography. I don't even know what the technology was that they used to take this. You'll probably remember this, Michael, but I think that came out in the late 70s or early 80s. And to me, I think that that was also very powerful because it did show the humanity of the, you know, the embryo and the fetus in gestation, and it made it much more difficult to think of it as a clump of cells. And I think Laura's correct in saying that technology has also brought us a lot closer to the idea, as a matter of science, that this is a human life right from the moment of conception.
I mean, I absolutely agree with the caller. I think what you're referring to is a Life magazine, I think, did some very good color photos of fetal development that really were very powerful and persuaded a lot of people. But I agree, the ultrasound technology has gotten much, much better, that you know, people can really see very vivid images of their preborn children. And not only that, but very often you see pictures of ultrasounds kind of showing up, you know, on bulletin boards and on refrigerators. And I think this had a very subtle but very profound impact on this debate. So I certainly agree. Ultrasound technology, developments in ultrasound technology, I think have been very helpful to pro-lifers.
Well, and I also think that, you know, we hear a lot of talk about following the science, follow the science, follow the science. I mean, there is a basic scientific argument here, and we make it on the pro-life side all the time, is that a fertilized egg is life at least from the moment that it first divides, it is human at its every single point of its life, and therefore is human life. It is actual life, and it is not potential life, as we often hear. It's not potential life. It's not a clump of cells. And I think that the more that people talk about following the science, Michael, that's another path for us. And I think we're good at taking that path, but that's another path that we have to promote, especially these days when you hear everybody saying, well, follow the science.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think biology and embryology textbooks are very clear that life begins at conception. And, a friend of mine even, did a survey of, PhD biologists. And ask them, when they thought life begins. And very high percentage, over 90% of biology PhDs agreed that life does begin at conception. So, I mean, the science is clear. I think that, many religious people are pro-life, and I think that that's great. But you can make very good non-religious arguments that are very sound to convince people who may not be of faith. I'm very pleased that you have groups like Secular Pro-Life that try to make some, non-theological arguments that try to reach out to agnostics and atheists. I've always felt that everybody should be pro-life. I think there's good arguments for Christians, there's good arguments for non-Christians, and there's good arguments for people of no faith tradition at all.
And before we go, we've got about 30 seconds left. I know that you do a lot of work on the impact of state-level laws on abortion. Just give us a brief idea of what you think, where you think this law from Arkansas is going to end up landing here.
Well, you've seen a number of states, especially in the South, pass some very good, very solid protective laws that really indicate that people in those states really want kind of comprehensive protection for unborn children. They don't just want to tinker at the margins. They want laws that are really going to place very good legal protection for unborn children. Alabama did something similar, last year. It's hard to say what's going to happen. The Supreme Court may choose to hear those cases. They may choose to hear some other cases, but I think just the cases that are coming up are good.
Dr. Michael, we're gonna have to leave it at that. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Did you ever tell someone you'd pray for them? Now's your chance. Hi, this is Father Rocky with our 27th lesson on the Mass. After directing her prayers of offering to God the Father through Jesus Christ, the priest prays for the Church, the Pope, the local bishop, and all who holding to the truth and on the Catholic and Apostolic faith. And then he says, Memento, which is Latin for remember. Remember, Lord, your servants, N. At this point, the priest and all the people pause to pray in silence for a few moments. What do they pray for? Actually, the question is, who do they pray for? They pray for N. With the N signifying the first letter of the Latin word nomen, which means name. The moments arrive to pray for people and for their needs because the Mass is first of all an opportunity for prayer of petition. Who do you pray for at Mass? You have been joining me for Lenten Lessons on the Mass. Now I'd like to invite you to join me for Mass itself at noon Central.
And join us for Class After Mass. It's the Faith Explained on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
All the issues, one place. One place. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 30 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Just want to thank Dr. Michael New again for being on the previous segment, and you can go over to nationalreview.com and read the rest of that essay that he has over there, deconstructing those numbers about the abortion industry, about the decline in abortions year on year from 1980, and some of the rest of the data, some of the debunking he does of the Washington Post article. It's excellent work over there, so be sure to check that out. Also, be sure to stay tuned, because after this show, you can listen to the Cale Clark Show at 5 Central Time this afternoon. Today, they're discussing St. Joseph in Scripture, what does it mean to fear God, and revenge bedtime procrastination. I have no idea what that means, but I am not going to put that one off. I am definitely going to listen to Cale today to find out what revenge bedtime procrastination might be. It's very interesting stuff coming up on the Cale Clark Show. Joining us now, though, is Joshua Thompson from Pacific Legal Foundation. He is the director of legal talent there. His practice has covered all of PLF's practice areas with a particular focus on equality before the law. That's pacificlegal.org. And today we are going to be talking about unionization in California's agricultural community and a legal case that they're bringing about private property rights in unionization. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm going to promise not to put you on the spot here to ask you to tell me what revenge bedtime procrastination might be. I am really excited to find out what Kale has in mind with that. But I'm very excited to talk about this case here that is being brought on behalf of a California company, agricultural company, that was shocked to find out that California regulation requires him to allow union organizers to occupy his property for a significant amount of time in attempts to unionize his workforce. Being a former Californian myself, I'm actually not terribly surprised about this regulation, but I think it does raise a number of interesting issues, both in regards to unionization and in regards to private property.
Sure, absolutely, and you're right. Our client was certainly shocked the day that the union showed up a cold Saturday morning in the middle of his harvest season. He's a strawberry plant grower, and they came onto his property. And normally, you'd think when someone comes onto your property, you'd be able to call the police and eject them because they have no right to be on your private property. But he was shocked to learn that California actually has a regulation that allows union organizers onto private agricultural businesses for 120 days out of the year, 3 hours each day. And he had absolutely no right to eject them, even though they were unwelcome.
So this goes back to 1975. And if you go to pacificlegal.org, the case files are there. In fact, you can get the PDFs of the various motions that have been filed in this case. And I mean, 1975 was a very different kind of time. This was around the time that, Cesar Chavez was doing his organizing primarily in California, although I think it extended farther than that, and trying to improve conditions for farm workers, both migrant and otherwise. This was a fairly celebrated period, I think, in terms of California's agricultural labor issues. Cesar Chavez, of course, a very revered figure in those circles, and it seems to me that this was probably a response to the conditions, and you mentioned this in your brief here, the conditions that were attendant at that time in terms of who the workers were, what kind of access they had to information, and that sort of thing. And I think what you're arguing here is that this regulation may have fit 1975. It doesn't fit 2021.
Yeah, I think it's certainly true that in 1975 there weren't cell phones, there weren't UFW radio stations, wasn't social media, and there are a lot of conditions that are present today and that the UFW and the other unions regularly use to contact workers that are certainly prevalent today, and there are different circumstances. I probably wouldn't go so far as to say it was justified in 1975.
Right.
I think what this access regulation does by taking the property right for such a long period of time, 120 days, it's probably never justified. And if the government wants that type of property right, it can certainly always pay for it. But it is undoubtedly true that to the extent it was justified in 1975, circumstances have wildly changed. And not only does the union possess all these other means to contact workers and inform them of their rights, but with our clients in particular, they in fact have done so. On the day before they were about to storm our client's property up in Doris, California, they went to the hotels where the workers were housed and urged them to strike with them and to join them. And they didn't have very much success that day, but I think it does go to demonstrate that the unions have many different avenues in which to contact workers other than trampling onto the private property of these agricultural businesses.
Right, and I think that this is part of the reason why the Supreme Court wants to hear this case. I think that this is something that they want to settle. I'm a little surprised, though, to find out that this is regulation and not actual statute in California.
That's true. It is a regulation. It was adopted very quickly after the California Labor Relations Act was adopted. So it was, it's almost seen as part and parcel with that act since it's been around for roughly the exact same amount of time. But it was not adopted by the legislature. This is a regulation that the ALRB imposed, and I think that's what we're fighting. We're alleging it violates our clients' property rights under the Constitution.
Right, and the reason why I bring that up is the California legislature actually never really delved into this type of issue specifically, right? I mean, they authorized their labor board to deal with some of these issues. But this is not something, the reason why I bring this up, I just kind of want to emphasize this. This is not something that came through representative democracy or, you know, in California you have referenda, so it didn't pass through that either. This is not a statute in any sense. So this is really something that has been carved out by an appointed board that doesn't have any real direct accountability to voters, as opposed to, say, the state legislature, which does. And there's a different level of legitimacy, I would say, in a statute than there is necessarily a regulation in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, you know, certainly at Pacific Legal Foundation, we are regularly trying to cut back on the administrative state. We believe that its scope has grown too large and its unaccountability is a serious problem. I would hasten to add, though, that if the legislature adopted this rule, I think it would be just as unconstitutional.
Sure.
The principle here is if the government wants an easement, it has the power to take it. It has the power of eminent domain, and it can pay our clients. What it's trying to do here is to take the property interest and take it for free. And if it can do that here, it can do it in any host of different situations.
Right, and again, I am just really trying to parse through the various different nuances of this. I'm more leery of regulation than I am of statute. I am also, you know, cognizant of the fact that this really is a private property issue, which would be attended in either one of these approaches. Had California taken either one of these approaches. But I always think of regulation as being somewhat more prone to, let me put it this way, maybe somewhat less, there may be a different level of scrutiny applied to regulation than there might be to statute. Not necessarily for strictly legal reasons, but just in terms of how courts respond to these types of things. Would you say that is something that might be in play here?
You know, I don't think the distinction between regulation and statute is in play here. And let me give you an example why. I know
okay.
This is a Catholic radio station. And imagine, for example, that the California legislature, a duly elected body, adopted a statute that said Planned Parenthood could come onto the property of Catholic schools for 120 days out of the year.
Yeah, it's a great analogy.
That sort of access right would be authorized under the rule that the court adopted, because it's not 24/7, it's only for 3 hours a day. And if that sort of access right could be authorized, then it ought not matter whether it's regulation or statute, certainly, but you can see how it would affect the property rights of any host of different organizations. Another example that I often throw out is, imagine that, you know, California is going through a homelessness crisis right now. Imagine that the legislature adopted a statute that said you had to allow for a tent on your property for 120 days out of the year. Or because of the prison overcrowding, you had to allow a room in your house. These types of easements onto your property ought to be considered physical takings that the government, if it so desires to take that property interest for you, it has to pay for it. If it doesn't pay, it's unconstitutional, and that's a violation of your property rights.
We are speaking with Joshua Thompson of Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org, and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, if you'd like to join the conversation. Joshua, and the other part of this, too, is you in the second example, at least, that you give, it would really be the government directly taking that easement, right, doing some sort of even a temporal eminent domain. For which you're right, they would have to have some sort of, you know, market compensation for whatever property that they're seizing. In this case, they're really presenting an easement for a third party, which I think is even less legitimate, and maybe entirely less legitimate. Even if you have a public interest in allowing union organizing to take place for the benefit of workers, it's still, I mean, unions are not a government entity, and so therefore don't have any sort of expectation of easement or eminent domain, even on a temporary basis.
That's true. The Fifth Amendment says that the government can take private property for public use if it pays just compensation. So I think the argument you're making is this isn't a public use. This is a private use. This is a use for the union. Now, we didn't make that argument in the court. A lot of the friends that filed briefs in the Supreme Court do make that argument and say, court, you didn't even need to reach whether this is an easement or not because this isn't a public use. Now, the reason we didn't make that argument is, unfortunately, there's this famous 2005 decision by the United States Supreme Court called Kelo versus New London.
I was just about to bring that up, Joshua, because it's a terrible decision. Kelo is a terrible decision. But, yes, you're right. The precedent is there. Keep going with that.
Yeah, and in Kelo, what the city of New London, Connecticut, did is it took the house of a little old lady, little pink house, and gave it to Pfizer, this big pharmaceutical company, to sort of encourage this new tax base that would help the city fund different projects. So it took it right from one private party and gave it to another private party. And the Supreme Court said that wasn't a violation of the public use clause because, you know, maybe the government does have a public purpose in increasing the tax base. So that we think was a wrong decision. We think it certainly eviscerated the public use clause, and that's why we didn't bring that claim here, but I think the argument is a fair one.
And by the way, there's a very good movie about the Kelo decision, Little Pink House. You mentioned this. It starred Catherine Keener and, I can't remember the woman who played the antagonist in this. I can see her face and I can't think of her name, but it was actually produced by a friend of mine named Ted Ballacher. It's a very good movie that I think people will really enjoy. It's done very well. And if you miss the whole Kelo argument, it actually does a pretty good job of presenting it, and a very entertaining way of presenting it as well. So Joshua, I think you're right. I mean, I was going to bring that up too, and I knew that was sort of an issue even when I was, you know, presenting this argument. And I think the other part of this too is that there was a history of resistance to union organizing that sort of Gene Triplehorn, that was and I want to thank our producer here for reminding me of who that was. Gene Triplehorn was the other actress who was in Little Pink House, and both Catherine Keener and Gene Triplehorn did a great job of it. I highly recommend the film. It's really good. But getting back to the history of union organizing, there's been hard cases on both sides of union organizing, which was one of the reasons why legislatures, you know, boards like the one in California and even the courts were granting unions more access and requiring employers to grant some access to union organizing activities. Maybe not necessarily on their property, but I think in some cases on their property. How does this line up? We got about a minute before the break. We're going to bring you back after the break, of course, to finish up this, but I'm going to let you get started on the answer. How does this differ from the other access laws and regulations that are already in place for union organizing?
Certainly we want every worker to know their rights under California law, under federal law. Every worker has the right to unionize. If they can convince enough of their fellow colleagues to join them, they have that right, and there's nothing that our businesses can do to stop them from organizing.
Right.
But what is unique about this law is that it allows the entrance and occupation of private property, and it does it for 120 days a year.
Why 120 days? Is that the normal growing, the normal harvest season? I mean, I just find 120 days to be such an unusual number for this purpose.
It's actually 4 30-day periods, so they can come back within a year four different times for 30-day periods. So we shorthand that to say 120 days a year. But you're right, for a grower like Cedar Point Nursery, its growing season is only 6 weeks. That's the only time it really has seasonal workers, so the union can effectively occupy their property for the entire growing season and the entire harvest season that they're operating.
It's a fascinating case, and Joshua is going to come back with us after the break. Joshua Thompson from Pacific Legal Foundation. We're going to take some more of your calls at 888-914-9149, and you can find out more about this case at Pacific Legal Foundation, Cedar Point Nursery and Fowler Packing Company. Two growers that they are representing in this case. It's going to be heard by the Supreme Court. We'll talk a little bit more about the Supreme Court cases, the Supreme Court hearing on this as well when we come back. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani, and we will be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Trying to stay up on the headlines? The Drew Mariani Show is here for you.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're speaking to Joshua Thompson of Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org, and he is the director of legal talent there, and we are talking about the case that they are going to be bringing to the Supreme Court, the case of Cedar Point Nursery versus Hasid, and we're going to talk a little bit about the underlying court decision of that, which was in the district court, obviously. And Joshua, first off, the district court ruled that they didn't really see this as much in terms of a taking. From what I've read of the brief, I've really just scanned the brief, but it looks to me like they were not convinced that this was a taking in the sense of the constitutional prohibition against this.
Sure, there's really two different lines of simplified. There's two different lines of takings precedent. There's the one line that says when the government takes your property, it appropriates an interest in it. So like your Kelo example where the government actually uses eminent domain power or where it takes a physical thing, then right. It has to always pay just compensation. It's per se illegal and they have to pay. And there's another line of takings jurisprudence that says, think of your zoning laws where, say, the zoning law says you can't paint your house polka dot or you can't raise chickens in the middle of the city. Those types of zoning regulations regulate how you use your property. And when you bring a takings claim to a use restriction, the court analyzes it under this big ad hoc factual analysis. And most of the time the property owner loses because it's not a significant devaluation of the property. So what we argue in this case is that this should fall into that first bucket of cases. They are directly appropriating a segment of our property for 120 days out of the year. It's not regulating how we use it. It's actually physically occupying our property, and therefore these per se rules should apply. It should be automatic compensation. And the Ninth Circuit and the district court said, no, this is more like a use restriction, and you need to go through this other analysis. And we asked the Supreme Court to take up this issue. We say, no, this is different than a use restriction. This is an occupation of property, and therefore a per se rule should apply. It should be automatically illegal unless they pay for it. And that's the issue that the Supreme Court will rule on. We have our hearing on Monday, and we'll hear a decision from the Supreme Court on that issue by the end of by summertime.
By the end of June, at the very latest, because that's when the term ends. And if that's usually when, usually not always, that's usually when the more divisive cases are announced, but not necessarily, and it really could come almost any time after that. What I find interesting about this, though, is that I'm not aware of this being a conflict in other districts, right? Sometimes when the Supreme Court will take a case because it sees two very different results on the same issue in two different districts of the appellate court, like the Ninth Circuit and the First Circuit, and that type of thing. I'm not necessarily aware that there's anything going on like this where there's been a different kind of adjudication on this issue. And so I find it interesting that you got granted cert in this case. And I would imagine that you feel at least a little bit positively about that development just on the basis of there are four justices that are interested in reviewing this case.
Yeah, you're right. That's when the Supreme Court takes the case. You need at least four justices to agree, and we are certainly hopeful that that signals something positive about the intended outcome, but I think we're still obligated to, you know, argue it well. I will push back a little bit, though. There is a circuit split here. There's a pretty stark one. We represented a client a couple years back that was in Pennsylvania, and there was a law that she was challenging that allowed the government to come onto your property to search for historic gravestones. And if they happened to find one on your property, then they would grant the easement to the public to come on during daylight hours. So it wasn't 24/7. Yes. It was sporadic. And the court said, yeah, of course that would be a taking. And there's a similar case in the federal circuit, which hears challenges against the federal government, where an EPA administrator would periodically come onto property to service wells. And the court said, yeah, that's, you know, even though it's not 24/7, that's a taking. So those two cases do demonstrate that circuit split that we think did help show the court that this was a case that it needed to grant to clarify the law. The Ninth Circuit, we believe, and we certainly argued in our brief, split sharply from the decisions of those other two courts.
That's very interesting. And I do remember the case in Pennsylvania. Now that you mentioned that, I had actually forgotten. That's a very interesting case, actually, about the old gravestones. That was a really interesting case for a lot of different reasons. And so that is a very interesting district split. So let me ask you, what is it that you're seeking at the Supreme Court? I mean, it looks like right now, based on the briefs that I've read, it looks like this case really hasn't even been heard to an extent of getting to argue the merits. This is something I think that we were talking about injunctions. We're talking about it almost looks like what you really just want is a fair day in court here.
That's true. This case is on the motion to dismiss, so the district court dismissed our claim because they said our theory was wrong completely, so there hasn't been any factual development of the record. That said, if the court agrees with us that the taking of this property interest is per se unconstitutional without compensation, then there isn't really a whole lot of factual development that needs to happen.
True.
The remedy that we're seeking here with respect to our two clients is an injunction and a declaration that if the government takes this, it's illegal. However, if we win and the court says that, yes, it is illegal, California still has the right to come back and say, okay, we're just going to pay you for it. We're going to give you the value of that easement. They always retain that right to condemn and pay for easements. So our argument is simply if they don't pay for it, and if they don't think this is so important that they have to pay for it, then it should be struck down as unconstitutional and enjoined.
And we're speaking with Joshua Thompson of Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. I mean, this is fascinating. It really is, because I think then at that point, there's a there's going to be a necessity to go back to the legislature and get funding for this particular regulation. And it's going to end up pushing this back onto lawmakers, where it probably should have started in the first place. And because as far as I know, boards have a limited amount of funds. And certainly this is not going to be the only agricultural business that's going to benefit if this if the Supreme Court ends up ruling in your favor. This is going to have a large impact on California growers, will it not?
Absolutely. It'll have a large impact on California growers directly, but it'll also provide the right check on government nationwide. The fact that they won't have the authority to take an easement as long as they put some sort of time limitations on it, I think is a very necessary protection for the private property rights of every American.
Well, and I think that that's really the issue here, too, right, is that you have government that really overreached. They had a public interest in mind, and I think that a public interest that many people will be very sympathetic with, which is that workers should have the ability and the choice to organize if they feel that it will benefit them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the state can just simply take your private property away to let them do that. And I think that that is a very necessary stand to make here.
Absolutely, it is. And that's the heart of our case, is that if the government thinks this is so important, then it can pay for it. I would add that, you know, I think if it does get struck down and if we prevail, I'm curious as to whether the California government would do that. By last count, I think the union only used this rule 5 times last year. So all of this hysteria that this is so necessary and they can't contact workers without it, I think is sort of falls on deaf ears if they're not even using it when they have the right to do it. There's 16,000 agricultural businesses in California, and it's barely used, and they're managing to contact workers in any other myriad of means every day.
Exactly. We've been speaking with Joshua Thompson of Pacific Legal Foundation. That's at pacificlegal.org. You can also, there's a big donate button there if you want to help them out with their assistance to people on behalf of freedom and private property rights. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.